orders for the destruction of enemy sabotage troops, and to declare non-compliance with these orders severely punishable. It must be made clear to the enemy that all sabotage troops will be exterminated without exception to the last man. This means that their chance of escaping with their lives is nil. Under no circumstances can they expect to be treated according to the rules of the Geneva Convention. If it should become necessary for reasons of interrogation to initially spare one man or two, then they are to be shot immediately after interrogation. This particular crime was to be kept strictly secret. General Jodl appended instructions to Hitler's directive, underlining his words. This order is intended for commanders only, and must not under any circumstances fall into enemy hands. They were directed to destroy all copies of it after they had duly taken note. It must have remained imprinted on their minds, for they proceeded to carry it out. A couple of instances of many may be given. On the night of March 22, 1944, two officers and 13 men of the 267th Special Reconnaissance Battalion of the U.S. Army landed from a naval craft far behind the German lines in Italy to demolish a railroad tunnel between La Spezia and Genoa. They were all in uniform and carried no civilian clothes. Captured 2 days later, they were executed by a firing squad on March 26th, without trial, on the direct orders of General Anton Dostler, commander of the 75th German Army Corps. Tried by a U.S. military tribunal shortly after the war, General Dostler justified his action by contending that he was merely obeying Hitler's commando order. He argued that he himself would have been court-martialed by the Führer if he had not obeyed. General Dostler was condemned to death by the U.S. military tribunal in Rome on October 12, 1945. Some 15 members of an Anglo-American military mission, including a war correspondent of the Associated Press and all in uniform, which had parachuted into Slovakia in January 1945, were executed at Mauthausen concentration camp on the orders of Dr. Ernst Kaltenbrunner, the successor of Heydrich as head of the SD and one of the defendants at Nuremberg. Kaltenbrunner was hanged at Nuremberg jail on the night of October 15th to 16th, 1946. Had it not been for the testimony of a camp adjutant who witnessed their execution, their murder might have remained unknown, for most of the files of the mass executions at this camp were destroyed. Nazi terror in the conquered lands. On October 22, 1941, a French newspaper, Le Phare, published the following notice. Cowardly criminals in the pay of England and Moscow killed the Feldkommandant of Nantes on the morning of October 20th. Up to now, the assassins have not been arrested. As expiation for this crime, I have ordered that 50 hostages be shot, to begin with. 50 more hostages will be shot in case the guilty should not be arrested between now and October 23rd by midnight. This became a familiar notice in the pages of the newspapers or on red posters edged with black in France, Belgium, Holland, Norway, Poland, and Russia. The proportion, publicly proclaimed by the Germans, was invariably 100-1, 100 hostages shot for every German killed. Though the taking of hostages was an ancient custom, much indulged in, for instance, by the Romans, it had not been generally practiced in modern times except by the Germans in the First World War and by the British in India and in South Africa during the Boer War. Under Hitler, however, the German army carried it out on a large scale during the Second War. Dozens of secret orders signed by General Keitel and lesser commanders were produced at Nuremberg ordering the taking and shooting of hostages. It is important, Keitel decreed on October 1, 1941, that these should include well-known leading personalities or members of their families. And General von Stulpnagel, the German commander in France, a year later stressed that the better known the hostages to be shot, the greater will be the deterrent effect on the perpetrators. In all, 29,660 French hostages were executed by the Germans during the war, and this figure did not include the 40,000 who died in French prisons. The figure for Poland was 8,000, and for Holland, some 2,000. In Denmark, what became known as a system of clearing murders was substituted for the publicly proclaimed shooting of hostages. On Hitler's express orders, reprisals for the killing of Germans in Denmark were to be carried out in secret on the proportion of 5-1. Thus, the great Danish pastor, poet, playwright, Kai Munk, one of the most beloved men in Scandinavia, was brutally murdered by the Germans, his body left on the road with a sign pinned to it. "Swine, you worked for Germany just the same." Of all the war crimes which he claimed he had to commit on the orders of Hitler, the worst of all, General Keitel said on the stand at Nuremberg, stemmed from the Nacht- und Nebelerlass, Night and Fog Decree. This grotesque order, reserved for the unfortunate inhabitants of the conquered territories in the West, was issued by Hitler himself on December 7, 1941. Its purpose, as the weird title indicates, was to seize persons endangering German security, who were not to be immediately executed, and make them vanish without a trace into the night and fog of the unknown in Germany. No information was to be given their families as to their fate, even when, as invariably occurred, it was merely a question of the place of burial in the Reich. On December 12, 1941, Keitel issued a directive explaining the Führer's orders. "In principle," he said, "the punishment for offenses committed against the German state is the death penalty. But if these offenses are punished with imprisonment, even with hard labor for life, this will be looked upon as a sign of weakness. Efficient intimidation can only be achieved either by capital punishment or by measures by which the relatives of the criminal and the population do not know his fate." The following February, Keitel enlarged on the Night and Fog Decree. In cases where the death penalty was not meted out within 8 days of a person's arrest, "the prisoners are to be transported to Germany secretly. These measures will have a deterrent effect because, A, the prisoners will vanish without leaving a trace, B, no information may be given as to their whereabouts or their fate." The SD was given charge of this macabre task, and its captured files are full of various orders pertaining to NN, for Nacht und Nebel, especially in regard to keeping the burial places of the victims strictly secret. How many Western Europeans disappeared into night and fog was never established at Nuremberg, but it appeared that few emerged from it alive. Some enlightening figures, however, were obtainable from the SD records concerning the number of victims of another terror operation in conquered territory which was applied to Russia. This particular exercise was carried out by what was known in Germany as the Einsatzgruppen, special action groups, or what might better be termed, in view of their performance, extermination squads. The first round figure of their achievement came out, as if by accident, at Nuremberg. One day, some time before the trial began, a young American naval officer, Lieutenant Commander Whitney R. Harris of the American Prosecution Staff, was interrogating Otto Ohlendorf on his wartime activities. It was known that this attractive-looking German intellectual of youthful appearance, he was 38, had been head of Amt III of Himmler's Central Security Office, RSHA, but during the last years of the war had spent most of his time as a foreign trade expert in the Ministry of Economics. He told his interrogator that apart from 1 year, he had spent the war period on official duty in Berlin. Asked what he had done during the year away, he replied, "I was chief of Einsatzgruppe D." Harris, a lawyer by training and by this time something of an intelligence authority on German affairs, knew quite a bit about the Einsatzgruppen. So he asked promptly, "During the year you were chief of Einsatzgruppe D, how many men, women, and children did your group kill?" Ohlendorf, Harris later remembered, shrugged his shoulders and with only the slightest hesitation answered, 90,000. The Einsatzgruppen had first been organized by Himmler and Heydrich to follow the German armies into Poland in 1939, and there round up the Jews and place them in ghettos. It was not until the beginning of the Russian campaign nearly 2 years later that, in agreement with the German army, they were ordered to follow the combat troops and to carry out one phase of the final solution. 4 Einsatzgruppen were formed for this purpose, groups A, B, C, D. It was the last one, which Ohlendorf commanded between June 1941 and June 1942, and it was assigned the southernmost sector in the Ukraine and attached to the 11th Army. Asked on the stand by Colonel John Harlan Amon what instructions it received, Ohlendorf answered, "The instructions were that the Jews and the Soviet political commissars were to be liquidated." "And when you say liquidated, do you mean killed?" Amon asked. "Yes, I mean killed," Ohlendorf answered, explaining that this took in the women and children as well as the men. "For what reason were the children massacred?" the Russian judge, General I.T. Nikitchenko, broke in to ask. Ohlendorf. The order was that the Jewish population should be totally exterminated. The judge, including the children? Ohlendorf, yes. The judge, were all the Jewish children murdered? Ohlendorf, yes. In response to further questioning by Amon and in his affidavit, Ohlendorf described how a typical killing took place. The Einsatz unit would enter a village or town and order the prominent Jewish citizens to call together all Jews for the purpose of resettlement, i.e., they were told they were being resettled elsewhere. They were requested to hand over their valuables and shortly before execution to surrender their outer clothing. They were transported to the place of executions, usually an anti-tank ditch, in trucks, always only as many as could be executed immediately. In this way, it was attempted to keep the span of time from the moment in which the victims knew what was about to happen to them until the time of their actual execution as short as possible. Then they were shot, kneeling or standing, by firing squads in a military manner, and the corpses thrown into the ditch. I never permitted the shooting by individuals, but ordered that several of the men should shoot at the same time in order to avoid direct personal responsibility. Other group leaders demanded that the victims lie down flat on the ground to be shot through the nape of the neck. I did not approve of these methods. Why? Asked Amon. Because, replied Ohlendorf, both for the victims and for those who carried out the executions, it was psychologically an immense burden to bear. In the spring of 1942, Ohlendorf then recounted, an order came from Himmler to change the method of execution of the women and children. There was a special reason for this. Henceforth, they were to be dispatched in gas vans, specially constructed for the purpose by two Berlin firms. The SD officer described to the tribunal how these remarkable vehicles worked. The actual purpose of these vans could not be seen from the outside. They looked like closed trucks and were so constructed that at the start of the motor, the gas, exhaust, was conducted into the van, causing death in 10 to 15 minutes. How were the victims induced to enter the vans? Colonel Amon wanted to know. They were told they were to be transported to another locality, Ohlendorf replied. Ohlendorf was tried at Nuremberg by a U.S. military tribunal, along with 21 others in the Einsatzgruppen case. 14 of them were condemned to death. Only 4, Ohlendorf and 3 other group commanders, were executed on June 8, 1951, at Landsberg prison, some 3.5 years after being sentenced. The death penalties for the others were commuted. The burial of the victims of the gas vans, he went on to complain, was a great ordeal for the members of the Einsatzgruppen. This was confirmed by a certain Dr. Becker, whom Ohlendorf identified as the constructor of the vans, in a document produced at Nuremberg. In a letter to headquarters, Dr. Becker objected to German SD men having to unload the corpses of the gassed women and children, calling attention to the immense psychological injuries and damage to their health which that work can have for these men. They complained to me about headaches which appeared after each unloading. Dr. Becker also pointed out to his superiors that the application of gas usually is not undertaken correctly. In order to come to an end as fast as possible, the driver presses the accelerator to the fullest extent. The persons to be executed suffer death from suffocation, and not death by dozing off, as was planned. Dr. Becker was quite a humanitarian, in his own mind, and ordered a change in technique. My directions now have proved that by correct adjustment of the levers, death comes faster and the prisoners fall asleep peacefully. Distorted faces and excretions, such as could be seen before, are no longer noticed. But the gas vans, as Ohlendorf testified, could dispatch only from 15 to 25 persons at a time, and this was entirely inadequate for the massacres on the scale which Hitler and Himmler had ordered. Inadequate, for example, for the job that was done at Kiev, the capital of the Ukraine, in just 2 days, September 29th and 30th, 1941, when, according to an official Einsatz report, 33,771 persons, mostly Jews, were executed. An eyewitness report by a German of how a comparatively minor mass execution was carried out in the Ukraine brought a hush of horror over the Nuremberg courtroom when it was read by the chief British prosecutor, Sir Hartley Shawcross. It was a sworn affidavit by Hermann Graeber, the manager and engineer of a branch office in the Ukraine of a German construction firm. On October 5, 1942, he witnessed the Einsatzkommandos, supported by Ukrainian militia, in action at the execution pits at Dubno in the Ukraine. It was a matter, he reported, of liquidating the town's 5,000 Jews. My foreman and I went directly to the pits. I heard rifle shots in quick succession from behind one of the earth mounds. The people who had got off the trucks, men, women, and children of all ages, had to undress upon the order of an SS man who carried a riding or dog whip. They had to put down their clothes in fixed places, sorted according to shoes, top clothing, and underclothing. I saw a heap of shoes of about 800 to 1,000 pairs, great piles of underlinen and clothing. Without screaming or weeping, these people undressed, stood around in family groups, kissed each other, said farewells, and waited for a sign from another SS man who stood near the pit, also with a whip in his hand. During the 15 minutes that I stood near the pit, I heard no complaint or plea for mercy. An old woman with snow-white hair was holding a one-year-old child in her arms and singing to it and tickling it. The child was cooing with delight. The parents were looking on with tears in their eyes. The father was holding the hand of a boy about 10 years old and speaking to him softly. The boy was fighting his tears. The father pointed to the sky, stroked his head, and seemed to explain something to him. At that moment, the SS man at the pit shouted something to his comrade. The latter counted off about 20 persons and instructed them to go behind the earth mound. I well remember a girl, slim and with black hair, who, as she passed close to me, pointed to herself and said, 23 years old. I walked around the mound and found myself confronted by a tremendous grave. People were closely wedged together and lying on top of each other so that only their heads were visible. Nearly all had blood running over their shoulders from their heads. Some of the people were still moving. Some were lifting their arms and turning their heads to show that they were still alive. The pit was already 2/3 full. I estimated that it contained about 1,000 people. I looked for the man who did the shooting. He was an SS man who sat at the edge of the narrow end of the pit, his feet dangling into the pit. He had a Tommy gun on his knees and was smoking a cigarette. The people, completely naked, went down some steps and clambered over the heads of the people lying there to the place to which the SS man directed them. They lay down in front of the dead or wounded people. Some caressed those who were still alive and spoke to them in a low voice. Then I heard a series of shots. I looked into the pit and saw that the bodies were twitching, or the heads lying already motionless on top of the bodies that lay beneath them. Blood was running from their necks. The next batch was approaching already. They went down into the pit, lined themselves up against the previous victims, and were shot. And so it went. Batch after batch. The next morning, the German engineer returned to the site. I saw about 30 naked people lying near the pit. Some of them were still alive. Later, the Jews still alive were ordered to throw the corpses into the pit. Then they themselves had to lie down in this to be shot in the neck. I swear before God that this is the absolute truth. How many Jews and Russian Communist Party functionaries, the former vastly outnumber the latter, were massacred by the Einsatzgruppen in Russia before the Red Army drove the Germans out? The exact total could never be computed at Nuremberg, but Himmler's records, uncoordinated as they were, give a rough idea. Ohlendorf's Einsatzgruppen D, with its 90,000 victims, did not do as well as some of the other groups. Group A, for instance, in the north, reported on January 31, 1942, that it had executed 229,052 Jews in the Baltic region and in White Russia. Its commander, Franz Stahlecker, reported to Himmler that he was having difficulty in the latter province because of a late start after the heavy frost set in, which made mass executions much more difficult. Nevertheless, he reported, 41,000 Jews in White Russia have been shot up to now. Stahlecker, who was disposed of later in the year by Soviet partisans, enclosed with his report a handsome map showing the number of those done to death, symbolized by coffins, in each area under his command. In Lithuania alone, the map showed, 136,421 Jews had been slain. Some 34,000 had been spared for the time being, as they were needed for labor. Estonia, which had relatively few Jews, was declared in this report to be Jew-free. The Einsatzgruppen firing squads, after a let-up during the severe winter, banged away all through the summer of 1942. Some 55,000 more Jews were exterminated in White Russia by July 1st, and in October the remaining 16,200 inhabitants of the Minsk ghetto were dispatched in one day. By November, Himmler could report to Hitler that 363,211 Jews had been killed in Russia from August through October, though the figure was probably somewhat exaggerated to please the bloodthirsty Führer. On August 31st, Himmler had ordered an Einsatz detachment to execute 100 inmates of the Minsk prison, so that he could see how it was done. According to Bach Zalewski, a high officer in the SS who was present, Himmler almost swooned when he saw the effect of the first volley from the firing squad. A few minutes later, when the shots failed to kill two Jewish women outright, the SS Führer became hysterical. One result of this experience was an order from Himmler that henceforth the women and children should not be shot, but dispatched in the gas vans. All in all, according to Karl Eichmann, the head of the Jewish office of the Gestapo, 2 million persons, almost all Jews, were liquidated by the Einsatzgruppen in the East. But this is almost certainly an exaggeration. It is strange but true that the SS bigwigs were so proud of their exterminations that they often reported swollen figures to please Himmler and Hitler. Himmler's own statistician, Dr. Richard Korher, reported to his chief on March 23, 1943, that a total of 633,300 Jews in Russia had been resettled, a euphemism for massacre by the Einsatzgruppen. Surprisingly enough, this figure tallies fairly well with exhaustive studies later made by a number of experts. Add another 100,000 slain in the last 2 years of the war, and the figure is probably as accurate as we will ever have. The number of Soviet Communist Party functionaries slain by the Einsatzgruppen has never been estimated, as far as I know. Most SD reports lump them together with the Jews. In one report of Group A, dated October 15, 1941, some 3,387 communists are listed among the 121,817 executed, the rest being Jews, but the same report often lists the two together. High as it is small compared to the number of Jews who were done to death in Himmler's extermination camps when the final solution came to be carried out. The final solution. One fine June day of 1946 at Nuremberg, three members of the American prosecution staff were interrogating SS Obergruppenführer Oswald Pohl, who, among other things, had been in charge of work projects for the inmates of the Nazi concentration camps. Pohl, a naval officer before he joined the SS, had gone into hiding after the German collapse, and had not been apprehended until a year later, in May 1946, when he was discovered working on a farm disguised as a farmhand. Pohl was condemned to death in the so-called concentration camp case by a U.S. military tribunal on November 3, 1947, and hanged in Landsberg prison on June 8, 1951, along with Ohlendorf and others. In answer to one question, Pohl used a term with which the Nuremberg prosecution, busy for months in poring over millions of words from the captured documents, had begun to become familiar. A certain colleague by the name of Hirsch had, Pohl said, been employed by Himmler in the final solution of the Jewish question. And what was that? Pohl was asked. The extermination of Jewry, he answered. The expression crept with increasing frequency into the vocabulary and the files of the leading Nazis as the war progressed, its seeming innocence apparently sparing these men the pain of reminding one another what it meant. And perhaps, too, they may have thought furnishing a certain cover for their guilt should the incriminating papers ever come to light. Indeed, at the Nuremberg trials, most of the Nazi chiefs denied that they knew what it signified, and Goering contended he had never used the term, but this pretense was soon exploded. In the case against the Fat Reich Marshal, a directive was produced which he had sent Heydrich, the chief of the SD, on July 31, 1941, when the Einsatzgruppen were already falling with gusto to their extermination tasks in Russia. I herewith commission you, Goering instructed Heydrich, to carry out all preparations with regard to a total solution of the Jewish question in those territories of Europe which are under German influence. I furthermore charge you to submit to me as soon as possible a draft showing the measures already taken for the execution of the intended final solution of the Jewish question. A faulty translation of the last line, rendering the German word Endlösung, as desired solution instead of final solution in the English copy of the document, led Justice Jackson, who did not know German, to allow Göring under cross-examination to get away with his contention that he never used the sinister term. "The first time I learned of these terrible exterminations," Göring exclaimed at one point, "was right here in Nuremberg." Heydrich knew very well what Göring meant by the term, for he had used it himself nearly a year before, at a secret meeting after the fall of Poland, in which he had outlined the first step in the final solution, which consisted of concentrating all the Jews in the ghettos of the large cities, where it would be easy to dispatch them to their final fate. As it worked out, the final solution was what Adolf Hitler had long had in mind, and what he had publicly proclaimed even before the war started. In his speech to the Reichstag on January 30, 1939, he had said, "If the international Jewish financiers should again succeed in plunging the nations into a world war, the result will be the annihilation of the Jewish race throughout Europe." This was a prophecy, he said, and he repeated it five times verbatim in subsequent public utterances. It made no difference that not the international Jewish financiers, but he himself plunged the world into armed conflict. What mattered to Hitler was that there was now a world war, and that it afforded him, after he had conquered vast regions in the East where most of Europe's Jews lived, the opportunity to carry out their annihilation. By the time the invasion of Russia began, he had given the necessary orders. What became known in high Nazi circles as the Führer Order on the Final Solution apparently was never committed to paper. At least no copy of it has yet been unearthed in the captured Nazi documents. All the evidence shows that it was most probably given verbally to Göring, Himmler, and Heydrich, who passed it down during the summer and fall of 1941. A number of witnesses testified at Nuremberg that they had heard of it, but none admitted ever seeing it. Thus Hans Lammers, the bull-headed chief of the Reich Chancellery, when pressed on the witness stand, replied, "I knew that a Führer order was transmitted by Göring to Heydrich. This order was called Final Solution of the Jewish Problem." But Lammers claimed, as did so many others on the stand, that he did not really know what it was all about until Allied counsel revealed it at Nuremberg. Lammers was sentenced in April 1949 to 20 years imprisonment by a U.S. military tribunal at Nuremberg, chiefly because of his responsibility in the anti-Jewish decrees. But as in the case of most of the other convicted Nazis, whose sentences were greatly reduced by the American authorities, his term was commuted in 1951 to 10 years, and he was released from Landsberg prison at the end of that year, after serving a total of 6 years from the date of his first imprisonment. It might be noted here that most Germans, at least so far as their sentiment was represented in the West German Parliament, did not approve of even the relatively mild sentences meted out to Hitler's accomplices. A number of them, handed over by the Allies to German custody, were not even prosecuted, even when they were accused of mass murder, and some of them quickly found employment in the Bonn government. By the beginning of 1942, the time had come, as Heydrich said, to clear up the fundamental problems of the final solution, so that it could at last be carried out and concluded. For this purpose, Heydrich convened a meeting of representatives of the various ministries and agencies of the SS-SD at the pleasant Berlin suburb of Wannsee, on January 20, 1942, the minutes of which played an important part in some of the later Nuremberg trials. Despite the current setback of the Wehrmacht in Russia, the Nazi officials believed that the war was almost won, and that Germany would shortly be ruling all of Europe, including England and Ireland. Therefore, Heydrich told the assembly of some 15 high officials, "In the course of this final solution of the European Jewish problem, approximately 11 million Jews are involved." He then rattled off the figures for each country. There were only 131,800 Jews left in the original Reich territory, out of a quarter of a million in 1939. But in the USSR, he said, there were 5 million, in the Ukraine 3 million, in the General Government of Poland 2.25 million, in France 750,000, and in England 250,000. The clear implication was that all 11 million must be exterminated. He then explained how this considerable task was to be carried out. "The Jews should now, in the course of the final solution, be brought to the East for use as labor. In big labor gangs, with separation of sexes, the Jews capable of work are brought to these areas and employed in road building, in which task undoubtedly a great part will fall through natural diminution. The remnant that finally is able to survive all this, since this is undoubtedly the part with the strongest resistance, must be treated accordingly, since these people, representing a natural selection, are to be regarded as the germ cell of a new Jewish development. In other words, the Jews of Europe were first to be transported to the conquered East, then worked to death, and the few tough ones who survived simply put to death. And the Jews, the millions of them who resided in the East and were already on hand? State Secretary Dr. Josef Bühler, representing the Governor General of Poland, had a ready suggestion for them. There were nearly 2.5 million Jews in Poland, he said, who constituted a great danger. They were, he explained, bearers of disease, black market operators, and furthermore unfit for work. There was no transportation problem with these 2.5 million souls. They were already there. I have only one request, Dr. Bühler concluded, that the Jewish problem in my territory be solved as quickly as possible. The good state secretary betrayed an impatience which was shared in high Nazi circles right up to Hitler. None of them understood at this time, not in fact until toward the end of 1942 when it was too late, how valuable the millions of Jews might be to the Reich as slave labor. At this point they only understood that working millions of Jews to death on the roads of Russia might take some time. Consequently, long before these unfortunate people could be worked to death, in most cases the attempt was not even begun, Hitler and Himmler decided to dispatch them by quicker means. There were two, principally. One of them, as we have seen, had begun shortly after the invasion of Russia in the summer of 1941. This was the method of mass slaughter of the Polish and Russian Jews by the flying firing squads of the Einsatzgruppen, which accounted for some 750,000. It was this method of achieving the final solution that Himmler had in mind when he addressed the SS generals at Posen on October 4, 1943. I also want to talk to you quite frankly on a very grave matter. Among ourselves it should be mentioned quite frankly, and yet we will never speak of it publicly. I mean the extermination of the Jewish race. Most of you must know what it means when 100 corpses are lying side by side, or 500, or 1,000. To have stuck it out, and at the same time, apart from exceptions caused by human weakness, to have remained decent fellows. That is what has made us hard. This is a page of glory in our history which has never been written and is never to be written. No doubt the bespectacled SS Führer, who had almost fainted at the sight of 100 Eastern Jews, including women, being executed for his own delectation, would have seen in the efficient working by SS officers of the gas chambers in the extermination camps an even more glorious page in German history. For it was in these death camps that the final solution achieved its most ghastly success. The extermination camps. All the 30-odd principal Nazi concentration camps were death camps, and millions of tortured, starved inmates perished in them. Kogan estimates the number at 7,125,000 out of a total of 7,820,000 inmates, but the figure undoubtedly is too high. Kogan, The Theory and Practice of Hell, page 227. Though the authorities kept records, each camp had its official Totenbuch, death book, they were incomplete and in many cases were destroyed as the victorious Allies closed in. Part of one Totenbuch that survived at Mauthausen listed 35,318 deaths from January 1939 to April 1945. The camp commander, Franz Zierreis, put the total number at 65,000. At the end of 1942, when the need of slave labor began to be acute, Himmler ordered that the death rate in the concentration camps must be reduced. Because of the labor shortage, he had been displeased at a report received in his office that of the 136,700 commitments to concentration camps between June and November 1942, some 70,610 had died, and that in addition, 9,267 had been executed and 27,846 transferred, to the gas chamber, that is. This did not leave very many for labor duties. But it was in the extermination camps, the Vernichtungslager, where most progress was made toward the final solution. The greatest and most renowned of these was Auschwitz, whose four huge gas chambers and adjoining crematoria gave it a capacity for death and burial far beyond that of the others. Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, and Chelmno, all in Poland. There were other minor extermination camps near Riga, Vilna, Minsk, Kaunas, and Lvov, but they were distinguished from the main ones in that they killed by shooting rather than by gas. For a time, there was quite a bit of rivalry among the SS leaders as to which was the most efficient gas to speed the Jews to their death. Speed was an important factor, especially at Auschwitz, where toward the end the camp was setting new records by gassing 6,000 victims a day. One of the camp's commanders for a period was Rudolf Höss, an ex-convict once found guilty of murder, who deposed at Nuremberg on the superiority of the gas he employed. Born in 1900, the son of a small shopkeeper in Baden-Baden, Höss was pressured by his pious Catholic father to become a priest. Instead, he joined the Nazi Party in 1922. The next year, he was implicated in the murder of a schoolteacher who allegedly had denounced Leo Schlageter, a German saboteur in the Ruhr who was executed by the French and became a Nazi martyr. Höss received a life sentence. He was released in a general amnesty in 1928, joined the SS 2 years later, and in 1934 became a member of the Death's Head group of the SS, whose principal job was the guarding of the concentration camps. His first job in this unit was at Dachau. Thus he spent almost his entire adult life, first as a prisoner, and then as a jailer. He freely, and even exaggeratedly, testified to his killings both on the stand at Nuremberg and in affidavits for the prosecution. Turned over later to the Poles, he was sentenced to death, and in March 1947 hanged at Auschwitz, the scene of his greatest crimes. The final solution of the Jewish question meant the complete extermination of all Jews in Europe. I was ordered to establish extermination facilities at Auschwitz in June 1941. At that time, there were already in the general government of Poland three other extermination camps, Belzec, Treblinka, and Wolzec. I visited Treblinka to find out how they carried out their extermination. The camp commandant at Treblinka told me that he had liquidated 80,000 in the course of half a year. He was principally concerned with liquidating all the Jews from the Warsaw Ghetto, a task which, because of the large numbers involved and because of, at the end, armed resistance, could not be completed, as we shall see, until 1943. He used monoxide gas, and I did not think that his methods were very efficient. So when I set up the extermination building at Auschwitz, I used Zyklon B, which was a crystallized prussic acid which we dropped into the death chamber from a small opening. It took from 3 to 15 minutes to kill the people in the death chamber, depending upon climatic conditions. We knew when the people were dead because their screaming stopped. We usually waited about a half hour before we opened the doors and removed the bodies. After the bodies were removed, our special commandos took off the rings and extracted the gold from the teeth of the corpses. Another improvement we made over Treblinka was that we built our gas chambers to accommodate 2,000 people at one time, whereas at Treblinka their 10 gas chambers only accommodated 200 people each. Höss then explained how the victims were selected for the gas chambers, since not all the incoming prisoners were done away with, at least not at once, because some of them were needed to labor in the IG Farben chemical works and Krupp's factory until they became exhausted and were ready for the final solution. We had two SS doctors on duty at Auschwitz to examine the incoming transports of prisoners. These would be marched by one of the doctors, who would make spot decisions as they walked by. Those who were fit to work were sent into the camp. Others were sent immediately to the extermination plants. Children of tender years were invariably exterminated, since by reason of their youth they were unable to work. Always Herr Höss kept making improvements in the art of mass killing. Still another improvement we made over Treblinka was that at Treblinka the victims almost always knew that they were to be exterminated, while at Auschwitz we endeavored to fool the victims into thinking that they were to go through a delousing process. Of course, frequently they realized our true intentions, and we sometimes had riots and difficulties. Very frequently women would hide their children under the clothes, but of course when we found them we would send the children in to be exterminated. We were required to carry out these exterminations in secrecy, but of course the foul and nauseating stench from the continuous burning of bodies permeated the entire area, and all of the people living in the surrounding communities knew that exterminations were going on at Auschwitz. Sometimes, Höss explained, a few special prisoners, apparently Russian prisoners of war, were simply killed by injections of benzene. Our doctors, he added, had orders to write ordinary death certificates and could put down any reason at all for the cause of death. Usually, heart disease was written down. Kogan, himself in Buchenwald for 8 years, gives samples. Patient died after prolonged suffering on blank at blank o'clock. Cause of death, cardiac weakness complicated by pneumonia. Kogan, The Theory and Practice of Hell, page 218. Such formalities were dispensed with at Auschwitz when the massive gassings began. Often the days dead were not even counted. To Hirse's blunt description may be added a brief composite picture of death and disposal at Auschwitz, as testified to by surviving inmates and jailers. The selection, which decided which Jews were to be worked and which ones immediately gassed, took place at the railroad siding as soon as the victims had been unloaded from the freight cars in which they had been locked without food or water for as much as a week, for many came from such distant parts as France, Holland, and Greece. Though there were heart-rending scenes as wives were torn away from husbands and children from parents, none of the captives, as Hirse testified and survivors agreed, realized just what was in store for them. In fact, some of them were given pretty picture postcards marked Waldsee to be signed and sent back home to their relatives with a printed inscription saying, "We are doing very well here. We have work and we are well treated. We await your arrival." The gas chambers themselves and the adjoining crematoria, viewed from a short distance, were not sinister-looking places at all. It was impossible to make them out for what they were. Over them were well-kept lawns with flower borders. The signs at the entrances merely said baths. The unsuspecting Jews thought they were simply being taken to the baths for the delousing which was customary at all camps, and taken to the accompaniment of sweet music. For there was light music, an orchestra of young and pretty girls all dressed in white blouses and navy blue skirts, as one survivor remembered, had been formed from among the inmates. While the selection was being made for the gas chambers, this unique musical ensemble played gay tunes from The Merry Widow and Tales of Hoffmann. Nothing solemn and somber from Beethoven. The death marches at Auschwitz were sprightly and merry tunes, straight out of Viennese and Parisian operetta. To such music, recalling as it did happier and more frivolous times, the men, women, and children were led into the bathhouses, where they were told to undress preparatory to taking a shower. Sometimes they were even given towels. Once they were inside the shower room, and perhaps this was the first moment that they may have suspected something was amiss, for as many as 2,000 of them were packed into the chamber like sardines, making it difficult to take a bath, the massive door was slid shut, locked, and hermetically sealed. Up above, where the well-groomed lawn and flower beds almost concealed the mushroom-shaped lids of vents that ran up from the Hall of Death, orderlies stood ready to drop into them the amethyst-blue crystals of hydrogen cyanide, or Zyklon B, which originally had been commercially manufactured as a strong disinfectant, and for which, as we have seen, Herr Hirse had with so much pride found a new use. Surviving prisoners, watching from blocks nearby, remembered how for a time the signal for the orderlies to pour the crystals down the vents was given by a Sergeant Mole. "Na, gib ihmen schon zu fressen." "All right, give 'em something to chew on." He would laugh, and the crystals would be poured through the openings, which were then sealed. Through heavy glass portholes, the executioners could watch what happened. The naked prisoners below would be looking up at the showers from which no water spouted, or perhaps at the floor, wondering why there were no drains. It took some moments for the gas to have much effect, but soon the inmates became aware that it was issuing from the perforations in the vents. It was then that they usually panicked, crowding away from the pipes and finally stampeding toward the huge metal door where, as Reitlinger puts it, they piled up in one blue, clammy, blood-spattered pyramid, clawing and mauling each other even in death. 20 or 30 minutes later, when the huge mass of naked flesh had ceased to writhe, pumps drew out the poisonous air, the large door was opened, and the men of the Sonderkommando took over. These were Jewish male inmates who were promised their lives and adequate food in return for performing the most ghastly job of all. They were inevitably and regularly dispatched in the gas chambers and replaced by new teams who continued to meet the same fate. The SS wanted no survivors to tell tales. Protected with gas masks and rubber boots and wielding hoses, they went to work. Reitlinger has described it. Their first task was to remove the blood and defecations before dragging the clawing dead apart with nooses and hooks, the prelude to the ghastly search for gold and the removal of teeth and hair, which were regarded by the Germans as strategic materials. Then the journey by lift or rail wagon to the furnaces, the mill that ground the clinker to fine ash, and the truck that scattered the ashes in the stream of the Sola. There was testimony at the Nuremberg trials that the ashes were sometimes sold as fertilizer. One Danzig firm, according to a document offered by the Russian prosecution, constructed an electrically heated tank for making soap out of human fat. Its recipe called for 12 pounds of human fat, 10 quarts of water, and 8 ounces to a pound of caustic soda, all boiled for 2 or 3 hours and then cooled. There had been, the records show, some lively competition among German businessmen to procure orders for building these death and disposal contraptions, and for furnishing the lethal blue crystals. The firm of I.A. Topfen Sons of Erfurt, manufacturers of heating equipment, won out in its bid for the crematoria at Auschwitz. The story of its business enterprise was revealed in a voluminous correspondence found in the records of the camp. A letter from the firm dated February 12, 1943, gives the tenor. To the Central Construction Office of the SS and Police, Auschwitz. Subject, Crematoria 2 and 3 for the camp. We acknowledge receipt of your order for 5 triple furnaces, including 2 electric elevators for raising the corpses and 1 emergency elevator. A practical installation for stoking coal was also ordered, and 1 for transporting ashes. The correspondence of 2 other firms engaged in the crematorium business popped up at the Nuremberg trials. The disposal of the corpses at a number of Nazi camps had attracted commercial competition. One of the oldest German companies in the field offered its drawings for crematoria to be built at a large SS camp in Belgrade. For putting the bodies into the furnace, we suggest simply a metal fork moving on cylinders. Each furnace will have an oven measuring only 24 by 18 inches, as coffins will not be used. For transporting the corpses from the storage points to the furnaces, we suggest using light carts on wheels, and we enclose diagrams of these drawn to scale. Another firm, C.H. Corey, also sought the Belgrade business, emphasizing its great experience in this field since it had already constructed 4 furnaces for Dachau and 5 for Lublin, which, it said, had given full satisfaction in practice. Following our verbal discussion regarding the delivery of equipment of simple construction for the burning of bodies, we are submitting plans for our perfected cremation ovens which operate with coal and which have hitherto given full satisfaction. We suggest 2 crematoria furnaces for the building planned, but we advise you to make further inquiries to make sure that 2 ovens will be sufficient for your requirements. We guarantee the effectiveness of the cremation ovens as well as their durability, the use of the best material, and our faultless workmanship. Awaiting your further word, we will be at your service. Heil Hitler, C.H. Corey, GmbH. In the end, even the strenuous efforts of German free enterprise, using the best material and providing faultless workmanship, proved inadequate for burning the corpses. The well-constructed crematoria fell far behind at a number of camps, but especially at Auschwitz in 1944, when as many as 6,000 bodies, Hirsch put it at as many as 16,000, had to be burned daily. For instance, in 46 days during the summer of 1944, between 250,000 and 300,000 Hungarian Jews alone were done to death at this camp. Even the gas chambers fell behind, and resort was made to mass shootings in the Einsatzkommando style. The bodies were simply thrown into ditches and burned, many of them only partly, and then earth was bulldozed over them. The camp commanders complained toward the end that the crematoria had proved not only inadequate, but uneconomical. The Zyklon B crystals that killed the victims in the first place were furnished by 2 German firms which had acquired the patent from IG Farben. These were Tesch and Stabenow of Hamburg and Degesch of Dessau, the former supplying 2 tons of the cyanide crystals a month, and the latter 3/4 of a ton. The bills of lading for the deliveries showed up at Nuremberg. The directors of both concerns contended that they had sold their product merely for fumigation purposes and were unaware that lethal use had been made of it, but this defense did not hold up. Letters were found from Tesch and Stabenow offering not only to supply the gas crystals but also the ventilating and heating equipment for extermination chambers. Besides, the inimitable Hirsch, who, once he started to confess, went the limit, testified that the directors of the Tesch Company could not have helped knowing how their product was being used, since they furnished enough to exterminate a couple of million people. A British military court was convinced of this at the trial of the two partners, Bruno Tesch and Karl Weinbacher, who were sentenced to death in 1946 and hanged. The director of the second firm, Dr. Gerhard Peters of Degesch of Dessau, got off more lightly. A German court sentenced him to 5 years imprisonment. Before the post-war trials in Germany, it had been generally believed that the mass killings were exclusively the work of a relatively few fanatical SS leaders. But the records of the courts leave no doubt of the complicity of a number of German businessmen, not only the Krupps and the directors of the IG Farben Chemical Trust, but smaller entrepreneurs who outwardly must have seemed to be the most prosaic and decent of men, pillars, like good businessmen everywhere, of their communities. How many hapless, innocent people, mostly Jews, but including a fairly large number of others, especially Russian prisoners of war, were slaughtered at the one camp of Auschwitz? The exact number will never be known. Hirsch himself in his affidavit gave an estimate of 2,500,000 victims executed and exterminated by gassing and burning, and at least another 500,000 who succumbed to starvation and disease, making a total of about 3 million. Later, at his own trial in Warsaw, he reduced the figure to 1,135,000. The Soviet government, which investigated the camp after it was overrun by the Red Army in January 1945, put the figure at 4 million. Reitlinger, on the basis of his own exhaustive study, doubts that the number gassed at Auschwitz was even as high as 750,000. He estimates that about 600,000 died in the gas chambers, to which he adds the unknown proportion of some 300,000 or more missing, who were shot or who died of starvation and disease. By any estimate, the figure is considerable. The bodies were burned, but the gold fillings in the teeth remained, and these were retrieved from the ashes if they had not already been yanked out by special squads working over the clammy piles of corpses. Sometimes they were pulled out before the victims were slain. A secret report of the German warden of the prison at Minsk disclosed that after he had commandeered the services of a Jewish dentist, all the Jews had their gold bridgework crowns and fillings pulled or broken out. This happens always 1 to 2 hours before the special action. The warden noted that of 516 German and Russian Jews executed at his prison during a 6-week period in the spring of 1943, some 336 had the gold yanked from their teeth. The gold was melted down and shipped, along with other valuables snatched from the condemned Jews, to the Reichsbank, where, under a secret agreement between Himmler and the bank's president, Dr. Walter Funk, it was deposited to the credit of the SS in an account given the cover name of Max Heiliger. This prize booty from the extermination camps included, besides gold from dentures, gold watches, earrings, bracelets, rings, necklaces, and even spectacles frames, for the Jews had been encouraged to bring all their valuables with them for the promised resettlement. There were also great stocks of jewelry, especially diamonds and much silverware, and there were great wads of banknotes. The Reichsbank, in fact, was overwhelmed by the Max Heiliger deposits. With its vaults filled to overflowing as early as 1942, the bank's profit-minded directors sought to turn the holdings into cold cash by disposing of them through the municipal pawn shops. One letter from the Reichsbank to the Berlin Municipal Pawn Shop, dated September 15th, speaks of a second shipment, and begins, "We submit to you the following valuables and the request for the best possible utilization." The list is long and itemized, and includes 154 gold watches, 1,601 gold earrings, 132 diamond rings, 784 silver pocket watches, and 160 diverse dentures, partly of gold. By the beginning of 1944, the Berlin pawn shop itself was overwhelmed by the flow of these stolen goods and informed the Reichsbank it could accept no more. When the Allies overran Germany, they discovered in some abandoned salt mines, where the Nazis had hidden part of their records and booty, enough left over from the Max Heiliger account to fill 3 huge vaults in the Frankfurt branch of the Reichsbank. Did the bankers know the sources of these unique deposits? The manager of the precious metals department of the Reichsbank deposed at Nuremberg that he and his associates began to notice that many shipments came from Lublin and Auschwitz. We all knew that these places were the sites of concentration camps. It was in the 10th delivery in November 1943 that dental gold appeared. The quantity of dental gold became unusually great. At Nuremberg, the notorious Oswald Pohl, chief of the economic office of the SS, who handled the transactions for his organization, emphasized that Dr. Funk and the officials and directors of the Reichsbank knew very well the origins of the goods they were trying to pawn. He explained in some detail the business deal between Funk and the SS concerning the delivery of valuables of dead Jews to the Reichsbank. He remembered a conversation with the bank's vice president, Dr. Emil Pohl. In this conversation, no doubt remained that the objects to be delivered came from Jews who had been killed in concentration camps. The objects in question were rings, watches, eyeglasses, gold bars, wedding rings, brooches, pins, gold fillings, and other valuables. Once, Pohl related, after an inspection tour through the vaults of the Reichsbank where the valuables from the dead Jews were inspected, Dr. Funk tendered the party a pleasant dinner in which the conversation turned around the unique origins of the booty. Dr. Funk was sentenced to life imprisonment at Nuremberg.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany, by William L. Shirer. The Warsaw Ghetto is no more. More than one eyewitness has commented on the spirit of resignation with which so many Jews met their deaths in the Nazi gas chambers or in the great execution pits of the Einsatz squads. Not all Jews submitted to extermination so gently. In the spring days of 1943, some 60,000 Jews walled up in the Warsaw Ghetto, all that remained of 400,000 who had been herded into this place like cattle in 1940, turned on their Nazi tormentors and fought. Perhaps no one has left a more grisly and authoritative account of the Warsaw Ghetto Rebellion than the proud SS officer who put it down. John Hersey's novel, The Wall, based on the Jewish records, is an epic story of the uprising. This German individual was Jürgen Strupp, SS Brigadeführer and Major General of Police. His eloquent official report, bound in leather, profusely illustrated and typed on 75 pages of elegant heavy bond paper, has survived. But not Strupp. He was caught after the war, sentenced to death by an American court at Dachau on March 22, 1947, for the shooting of hostages in Greece, and then extradited to Poland, where he was tried for the slaughter of the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. He was again sentenced to death and hanged at the scene of the crime on September 8, 1951. The report is entitled, The Warsaw Ghetto is No More. By the late autumn of 1940, a year after the Nazi conquest of Poland, the SS had rounded up some 400,000 Jews and sealed them off within a high wall from the rest of Warsaw in an area approximately 2.5 miles long and a mile wide around the old medieval ghetto. The district normally housed 160,000 persons, so there was overcrowding, but this was the least of the hardships. Governor Frank refused to allot enough food to keep even half of the 400,000 barely alive. Forbidden to leave the enclosure on the pain of being shot on sight, the Jews had no employment except for a few armament factories within the wall run by the Wehrmacht or by rapacious German businessmen who knew how to realize large profits from the use of slave labor. At least 100,000 Jews tried to survive on a bowl of soup a day, often boiled from straw, provided by the charity of the others. It was a losing struggle for life. But the ghetto population did not die fast enough from starvation and disease to suit Himmler, who in the summer of 1942 ordered the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto to be removed altogether for security reasons. On July 22nd, a great resettlement action was instituted. Between then and October 3rd, a total of 310,322 Jews, according to Strupp, were resettled. That is, they were transported to the extermination camps, most of them to Treblinka, where they were gassed. Still, Himmler was not satisfied. When he paid a surprise visit to Warsaw in January 1943 and discovered that 60,000 Jews were still alive in the ghetto, he ordered that the resettlement be completed by February 15th. This proved to be a difficult task. The severe winter and the demands of the army, whose disaster at Stalingrad and whose consequent retreat